Dave. The other is the Hubble Deep Field, which probably you also, which was a picture taken by the Hubble telescope through observations taken over a 10-day, found thousands of galaxies in this very blank-looking piece of sky. And almost every single object in this image, except for that star, is a galaxy. So it's very clear that as we go to further and further away galaxies, it becomes extremely hard to see any beautiful, it's hard to see much structure in the sky. How can we possibly understand the interstellar matter across time? Okay, but I'll start close by, then progressively go out. Alright, so everybody knows interstellar space is not a vacuum. The average density in the ISM is about 10 to the 12 particles per cc, per cubic centimeter. That sounds very high, but of course you have to remember that the average density in a room like this, at sea level, is about 10 to the 31 particles per cubic centimeter. Even some of the best vacuums in a laboratory are as much as 10 to the 24 particles per cc. Compared to these, even the best vacuums, ISM is truly... Why should we care about the ISM? Because again, I think I don't say this to this crowd here, but basically because stars are both born in the ISM, and when they die, they return the products of their hard labor back into the ISM. Orion, perfect stellar nursery, and the Crab supernova remnant, where you see star, and stars, in this case, there is still, see all these gaseous elements, and filaments and all stuff, that tells you that there is a lot of interaction going on between the star and the... So the ISM and the stars are closely coupled, and together they decide how a galaxy evolves and how indeed our universe as a whole evolves. Cartoon describes it pretty nicely. You have, you know, star formation happening in clouds like Orion stars, and also in Eagle Nebula you see stars forming. Things like that. Stellar birth here. After the star goes off the main sequence, you start seeing outer layers of the star being cast out, and you get stellar winds. Eventually, when the star dies, you get supernova remnants. On the way to becoming a white dwarf, a star of a lesser mass might planetary nebula like that, and again it spews out some of its outer layers into the material. So there's a constant exchange of recycling going on between the material we start and the material outside. In fact, that's how we believe chemically as a function of time. Okay, so the main constituents of ISM, again, as we all know, are the two main most important things are the gas and the dust. The gas can be atomic, which does not necessarily mean it's neutral. It can be ionized, but it's atomic. Or it can be molecular. It's extremely cold. Not only is it atomic, but the atoms are in fact combined into a molecular state. The other state of ISM is, of course, the dust. And you already saw Barnard objects and things like that. So dust is nothing but solid particles that is actually a tiny fraction by mass of the whole ISM. Gas is the main constituent of the ISM, 1% or so. The dust is only 1%. But as you saw from those images, it's still very, very important. Back to that point. Okay, so let's spend a minute talking about the atoms in the ISM. Most abundant, then comes helium, and several other elements are seen, right from the very abundant elements like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, which are important for life and things like that, all the way to much heavier elements. Zinc, copper, lead even. And how do we know this? We know this because of the absorption lines that the spectra of stars whose light passes through this intervening. And it was realized early on that the absorption lines from the interstellar gas are extremely narrow compared to the lines of the star itself. So that means the gas must be really cold compared to the... That is, of course, well known now. But the absorption lines usually in the optical or ultraviolet, that's how you detect this atomic gas. If it's ultraviolet, you need to be above the Earth's atmosphere and you need a space telescope like Hubble. Ground-based, if it's optical, you can do it with a ground-based telescope because the Earth's atmosphere does not, you know, you... And of course, in fact, when you take spectra at very high resolution, you see that not only do you see a single absorption line, but almost invariably all the time, the absorption line is split into a number of components. People who have taken spectra at a resolution of 200,000, something ridiculous, even more than that. It's so like 0.6 kilometers per second, maybe 300,000 kilometers per second is the speed of light. It's really finely sampled spectra. And at that kind of resolution, it's just phenomenal what kind of structure you can see. You're now probing the structure within the interstellar clouds on very fine scales, velocity dimension. By the way, if anything is not clear, please feel free to stop me. Okay, and as we mentioned before, the lines are very sharp and very narrow compared to stars. How about molecules? As again, you probably know, over 100 types of different molecules have been detected in the ISM. Of course, most abundant, again, is H2, molecular hydrogen, because hydrogen is the most abundant element. And H2 is relatively easy to form. But you also see many other molecules, carbon monoxide being one of the most common ones. But it's what is really amazing is you not only see the simple two-atom or three-atom molecules, you even see the complicated molecules. You see alcohol, see ethyl alcohol, kind of alcohol we drink, methyl alcohol, you know, various hydrogen cyanide, hydrogen sulfide, and all those things. And in fact, even raw materials for amino acids have been seen. And how do we detect molecules? That does not come from optical or UV spectroscopy, because the lines you're detecting in the molecules, those are transitions from rotational or vibrational modes of the molecule. So the atoms in the molecule, they might rotate around each other, or they might stretch, the molecule might stretch. Energy levels involved in that, they produce lines in the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum or in the infrared. Lines absorb either absorption or emission lines in radio or infrared. Right? And of course, what's the significance of these molecules? The main thing is that they exist in really cold and really dense and usually very dusty regions. Now, those are the places where stars form. And since we mentioned dust, let's spend a minute talking about dust. Interstellar dust grains, as you mentioned, those are small, about micrometer-sized particles. You know, there's a whole range, but typical size is a micron. And here is, in fact, a picture of the dust grain. You can see it's a single grain. It's a huge molecule, essentially. And what it is a combination of silicates, graphites, and ices. When I say ices, it could be H2O, it could be ammonia, water, ammonia, such, anything. But the core is basically made of either graphite or silicate. And then on the other parts of it is pictures like this, where the dust, how does the dust affect the star's light? Because we know it extinguishes light. You see these dark spots you saw in one of the images earlier. Stars are really hard to see. The other way dust affects the light is, of course, it reddens the light, because light gets scattered much more in the blue, red, from dust grains of this kind of size. The size of the particle is comparable to the wave. So that's why stars appear redder, because of dust scatter. And as I mentioned before, dust makes up about 1% of the ISM. So then why bother to study dust? It's only 1%. What role could it possibly play? Because visually, from those beautiful images you saw earlier, you already know that they do make a huge, they affect our perception of distant objects. In terms of processes governing the stars and the gas surrounding them, or the interstellar gas, one reason the dust is really important is that those little tiny grains, they act as catalysts. So on top of a little solid grain, two atoms of a gas, for example, two hydrogen atoms, can combine. And they find a surface, they're kind of like a meeting place, where they can stick together for enough time that they'll actually form a molecule. So molecules form in dusty regions. Dust grains themselves don't become a part of the molecule, of the gas, but they just act as catalysts. Right? Now that's how, so dust is needed to form molecules. What about destroying molecules? If you have molecules forming, but at the same time you have a very bright young star nearby, like an O star or a B star or something, that's going, the UV light from that can easily disrupt the molecule that just formed. So dust helps in preventing that by shielding the, gas from the outside hot UV radiation, because dust absorbs most of it or extinguishes. So the dust shields molecules and it helps to form the molecules. So dust is really important for forming molecules. Of course, as we know, formation of molecular clouds is essential to forming stars. On a scale much closer to home, of course, we know that dust grains are also the seeds for forming planetesimals, which eventually grow into planets. So it's very important even for that purpose. In the more distant universe, again, now I'm talking about megaparsecs or gigaparsecs, billions of light years. On such enormous scales, of course, the effects of dust add up. And the presence of dust along the line of sight to some very far away galaxy clearly makes the galaxy much redder, much fainter, and it can even completely extinguish for all practical purposes, given a certain level of sensitivity, your background objects. So we could be entirely missing out on certain kinds of objects if there is enough dust. In fact, this is important for some of the most fundamental questions in the universe, namely, how big is the universe and how is it expanding? Lately, we've been hearing about the expansion of the universe accelerating. But is that really true, or can differences in dust properties at different times, can that account for some of that effect? So dust is very fundamental for all of these different reasons. And of course, you know how the dust and the gas are distributed in the Milky Way, dark dusty lanes here. Spiral galaxy like the Milky Way, it's concentrated mostly within the disk, especially within the spiral arms. An elliptical galaxy by comparison, there is much less cold interstellar gas. Okay, so far we talked about the ISM and the Milky Way. Now let's go out a little bit. These are some of our nearest neighbors, the Large Magellanic Cloud. So you see, it's had a lot of recent star formation, and it has even current star formation, of course. But you see some of the interstellar material in that galaxy right here. And of course, this is Andromeda. You see the dust lake. Okay. So now I'm going to go much further out and address the question of how can we study ISM in the distant universe. Remember that picture I showed you earlier with the Hubble Deep Field. The galaxies themselves, the entire galaxy, may fit on a few pixels. So how can we possibly study the intricate details about the ISM, which far away galaxy? Right? Before I get into that, are there any questions? Probably most of this was too basic for all of you. Okay, so no questions? Alright, fine. Okay, so the idea here is that if you go back in time, this is time evolving forward. So if you go back in time, early in time, gas, let's assume that you're studying one cubic, a certain size, maybe a cubic megapart of space. Early on, this gas was more or less uniformly distributed. Galaxies are formed yet. No stars are formed, obviously. And then as time went on, this very, very slight over-densities of some regions made more matter fall towards it. And then as a result, the gas became less homogeneous, became more concentrated in some regions. And then as that process continued, because of gravity, more and more gas got attracted to the slightly denser regions. And the contrast between the dense regions and the less dense regions, that grew. And so now we have this very fine web of structure where galaxies and clusters of galaxies and superclusters there, they would be distributed along these filaments. And then in between them you have what can be considered almost as voids. Big regions where there are far fewer galaxies, or gas as well as the stars and obviously the galaxies, they're concentrated in these. So that's the overall expectation. But can we actually see the ISM evolve with time? So the driving questions for some of the research we're doing at USC are, first of all, how did galaxies evolve? So how did those stars and ISM that we see around us today, how did they get assembled? If you go back in time, if you go back early enough, you don't see all that. So how did that structure get established? Secondly, how did the rate of star formation evolve with time? Galaxies were not always forming stars. The Milky Way currently is not forming stars that way. We do some regions that have a lot of star formation, but compared to sometime in the back, about 10 billion years ago, Milky Way, so the galaxies were forming stars much more vigorously compared to today. So how did the rate of star formation change with time? And what made it change as well? And one of the questions I'm really interested in is, how did the chemical elements evolve with time? I'm talking about each of those questions, and then we'll talk about how exactly we approach these questions. So question number one, how did galaxies evolve? We know there are spirals, we know there are ellipticals. Okay? But what established these kind of morphological differences? And of course, spirals and ellipticals differ not just in their structure and their appearance, but also in the amount of gas, interstellar matter that they have. Spirals have a lot of cold ISM, whereas ellipticals have some hot gas, really hot gas, like million degrees spirals, but they don't have the cold gas like spirals. How about the rate at which stars form? This is again that Hubble Deep Field image I showed you earlier. Once this picture was taken, people all made an entire field out of it. Before this picture was taken, there were several very skeptical astronomers who didn't really see what was the point of pointing Hubble at a pretty blank-looking piece of star. But the power of that came because Hubble looked at it for 10 days in a row, and with Hubble's very sharp resolution. And what came out was really surprising. They saw thousands of galaxies in this piece of sky that was thought to be nearly blank from the ground. So what did we learn from this? One of the things that came out of this was that if you plot the rate at which galaxies form stars per volume, per cubic megaparsec, you plot that as a function of redshift. A long time ago, which I have, the star formation was happening much more vigorously than it is today. It's much higher at redshift of around 2. In case anyone doesn't remember what redshift is the expansion, is the Doppler shift because of the expansion of the universe. 0 redshift means today, and high redshift means early. So as we go to higher and higher redshifts, we are going further and further back in time. So the question that interests me here is this representative of the evolution of all galaxies? Any picture, no matter how deep, even with the Hubble, if you take a deep image, even though it's 10 days long, even at that kind of depth, you would still pick out the brighter galaxies more than fainter. Right? There has to be some limit below which you won't see the galaxies. So is this just picking out the brightest things, like the tips of the iceberg, or is it giving us a representative view of normal galaxies? So that is another question. And finally, how did elements evolve? We know that hydrogen, helium, lithium, they formed within a few minutes after the Big Bang. Everything else pretty much formed in stars, either during the regular main sequence star or after that star evolved and became a supernova and emphasized some of the very heavy elements during that supernova. So as we saw in this cartoon before, there's constant recycling going on. And so the elements that the star formed eventually find their way back into the ISM. Then the next generation of stars that forms out of that gas, they already inherit all those elements that the previous generations of stars are formed. Right? I mean, our sun and of course the planet, all the planets, they have carbon and iron and all those things, but our sun didn't do anything to form those. Those were already inherited from previous generations of supernovae that happened before the sun was even formed. So what I'm interested in is seeing this process actually evolve with time. Actually looking at galaxies further and further back in time and seeing how those elements gradually got formed. So how can we address all these goals? As we mentioned before, this is really hard to do because galaxy images themselves are very tiny once you go to galaxies. So the trick that we use is using quasars. Quasars are very bright objects that are believed to be powered by supermassive black holes, and they can be seen out to billions of light years. So they're essentially like flashlights for us, And when we look at the light of a background quasar, that, suppose this is the quasar, the light leaves the quasar and gets to us along this line of sight, and the Earth is somewhere here. Along that journey, the light goes through many galaxies along the line of sight. Just like for a star within the Milky Way, the light goes through interstellar clouds along the line of sight. Okay, it's the exact same idea. But now it's going through interstellar gas within separate galaxies. So you can study very far away galaxies by means of the absorption that they produce in the spectrum of this quasar, in the light of that quasar. So you may not have any clue what the galaxy looks like, but if you see a little dip in the light of the quasar, you know that there is something there. I'm sure you all heard of the word dark matter, right? So this is not exactly dark matter, but it's really trying to do something hard to detect by other means, but you can detect it if you time to go over all this, but I'm sure you all know what quasars are. Originally they were thought to be stars. They were discovered in radio originally, but it turned out that their very weird spectra were basically nothing but very highly redshifted spectra. So people were first when quasars were discovered, people were very puzzled by the kind of spectral lines they saw. And no element known on the Earth had any such lines known. But it was realized by Martin Schmidt that, in fact, all that was happening was these lights were enormously shifted to the red. The first quasar discovered was moving away from us at a speed of about 50 kilometers per second. It's far in excess of anything within the Milky Way galaxy. So this has to be something very far away. And the reason it's appearing to move that far is because of just the expansion of the universe. So they're not stars, we know that very well now. They're basically just the nuclei of galaxies. I don't really study the quasar itself, although that is in itself an extremely rich field. So that's that central part right there, that would be the quasar. And the center of the galaxy. You don't see the rest of the galaxy usually. There might be jets coming out of the galaxy. But anyway, I don't study the quasar itself, but for my purpose it's an excellent background, a very bright source. And I can study the shadows, so to say, in the light of that quasar, cast by the stuff that's... So how do we keep track of time? We do that with redshift. And again, redshift is basically, because of the expansion of the universe, the light gets shifted by significant amounts. Basically, the farther away the galaxies are, the faster they're moving away from us, as was discovered by Edwin Hubble. And because light takes a finite amount of time, light travels at a finite speed, that means when you're looking at high redshift objects, you're looking at an earlier epoch. Zero redshift is present-day epoch, and high redshift is way back. So zero redshift, this is in terms of look-back time, billions of years. The zero redshift today is look-back time of zero, by definition. Redshift of 2 is 10 billion years ago. Best estimates for the age of the observable universe are about 13.5 billion years. So already you can see at redshift of 1, you're more than two-thirds of the, or approximately at least one-half the age of the universe. By redshift of 2, you're more than two-thirds of the way, and so on. It's very highly non-linear. So zero redshift, I mean one redshift is not... Okay, so I don't know, red object there, that was the quasar. Now imagine the light leaving that quasar. Every time it passes through a cloud, you see absorption. When it passed through that big galaxy, you saw this big absorption. Too fast? Did everybody get to see what was happening? Okay, so the idea is before the light left the quasar, the spectrum was just this upper end. And then after it went through all those clouds, or early young galaxies, proto-galaxy, you saw it got inundated with all these absorption lines. Each of those absorption lines had something to tell us about some part of it. And that's what we do. We study these absorption lines. And the strongest of those, like the one continuum and the emission lines, those are coming from the quasar itself. Stuff that we later on, that stuff along the line of sight. It has nothing to do with that quasar, but it's far away galaxies. So it's very strong absorption lines that produce. Very strong absorption lines, those must be the regions where there is a huge amount of interstellar matter. huge amount of gas. And there are more than 2 times 10 to the 20 atoms per centimeter square. So if you imagine a very narrow thin column extending through that galaxy with a cross section of 1 centimeter square, there are more than 10 to the 20, 2 times 10 to the 20 atoms in that kind of a region to produce such very strong absorption. Quasar light is gone, there is no light left. So these are the absorbers that that are really interesting. And then there is a related class called the sub-DLAs. I'm going to call these DLAs. Right? Then the sub-DLAs, these are weaker than the DLAs. But they still have a lot of gas between 10 to the 19 to 2 times 10 to the 20 square. And together they contain most of the neutral gas in the universe. Remember, the stars are formed out of the cold and neutral gas. So these kind of absorption, these kind of objects, whatever is producing these very monstrous absorption lines, those are the places out of which all the stars we see today must have formed. Need that neutral gas, very cold gas, to form stars. So these are, in a sense, the progenitors, predecessors of today's galaxies. Study these in order to understand how some of the facilities we use are the Hubble, then Spitzer, which is an infrared telescope in space. Also the very large telescope in Chile, the Keck, Gemini, both in Hawaii, and Magellan telescopes in Chile, and so on. So, what do we find from all this? I'll describe some of the results. One thing we're interested in is, how did elements form with time, as I mentioned before. Most theories of how galaxies form, they predict that if you go way back in time, there were almost no heavy elements in galaxies. It was all almost pristine, hydrogen and helium. So if you go way back in time, high look back, large look back times, galaxies must be very metal poor. Now, by metal, I mean anything other than hydrogen and helium. Right? That's a very bad nomenclature in astronomy, but you all know that there are lots of very bad nomenclatures in astronomy. So metal, by metallicity, I mean metal to hydrogen ratio. The more rich a galaxy is in elements other than hydrogen helium, the higher that metallicity is going to be. The dashed line here at zero, that is the sun's level. So this is normalized to the sun's level. So today's metallicity, today's average metallicity in a galaxy like Milky Way is very close to the sun's own level of metallicity. Probably you know that the sun has by mass about 2% of its entire mass is in heavy elements. Hydrogen and helium make up them. So that 2% level, that is basically this reference that we take. Very high look back time, very high redshifts. Things are expected to be very poor, very low compared to the sun. And then as time goes on, these lines here predict, these are different models of evolution of galaxies, they predict that eventually you should reach the sun's level. And that sounds perfectly fine. Today we see stars like the sun, we see other galaxies, and they all seem to be more or less the sun's level, how much metals they have. But do we actually see that? That was not known, because there was no way to access the key absorption lines of elements that don't disappear into the dust grain phase. And those are a very volatile element, it doesn't get subbed into dust grains, and you can actually figure out a very accurate amount of for things like iron, all as I mentioned before, dust grains have silicates. The silicates have atoms like iron and magnesium, and silicon. So those kind of elements are bad for doing this kind of work because you may detect the gas phase, but you may detect the absorption in gas in the gaseous part of the ISM. But remember, the ISM also contains the dust, and the dust would be containing 90% of the iron. You know how to measure that. So for all of those reasons, this region was completely unknown until very recently. So we focused on this region. This is redshift, less than 1.5, or in terms of time, that's about 9 billion years, the past 9 billion years. And what did we find? We found something really surprising. Now, why do we care about this region? Because this is 70% of the cosmic history. And we were in a funny situation where we knew more about what was going on here than we did about this. So these black dots, black points, those show you what was actually observed with these absorption lines in the spectra of quasars. So So initially, at very early times, indeed the metallicity was low. Galaxies were didn't have any metals, as was expected according to these curves. But at more recent times, do they actually follow the curves or not? That was not known. To that, we've been looking into that. And with the Hubble telescope, we actually obtained some data at the very low redshifts. And also with the telescopes I mentioned earlier, like the Magellan telescope and the very large telescope in Chile, we increased sample tremendously. Yuzhna found that, in fact, nothing could be further from the truth. The galaxies are not doing anything like what the models are predicting. They're kind of saturating. They're reaching only about 20% of the sun's level. That sounds very weird, because our sun is not something special, and the Milky Way is not a special galaxy. So how could it be that we are up here and most other kind of normal, ordinary galaxies detected purely by accident because they have a quasar behind them? How come they are only here? So this came known as the missing metals problem. It's a missing metals problem for these kind of objects. So metals are expected to be there, but they're missing. So what's going on? Well, there are a variety of different possibilities that might be there, but one thing we wanted to check out was maybe we are not looking in the right places. Maybe these extremely strong objects are not the places with the most amount of star formation. They haven't really had much formation, right? So instead, what we perhaps might want to look at are those weaker absorption lines. If you remember, there's this other class of objects whose absorption lines are not that deep. So they have gas, a lot of gas, but not as much as that. So previously everybody was focusing on these, but nobody had actually looked at these. And that was because people thought these don't have as much gas, as much hydrogen, so they can't have as much metals. So we actually looked at those weaker absorption systems, weaker galaxies, which produce narrower absorption lines. In a sense, we were going beyond the DLS, beyond the damped lemon of observers, by looking at these so-called sub-damped lemon observers. Again, we've observed a large number of these objects. And what did we find? Surprisingly, we found that some of these objects can be extremely metal-rich. Here is one object. I'm showing you spectral lines of various elements. I'm sorry for the really small type. Can see the scales. Just flux versus wave versus velocity, wavelength. So all of these absorption lines are happening, getting produced by one single, by the same object at a redshift of 0.7. So when you look at these absorption lines, this is what the different elements were 6 billion years ago in this particular. A little after this was the formation of our solar system, 0.5 billion years ago. So that gives you a scale of what redshift. So what is shown here is zinc, iron, all different kinds of absorption lines are seen. But the zinc lines are unusually strong. These are normally very weak absorption lines. But in this particular case, they're really strong. And if we actually calculate how many atoms of zinc are there, and in fact, you can see there's not just one single cloud there. There's a whole bunch of clouds. In fact, there are 16 individual clouds seen at this resolution, all spewed along the line of sight, in that one object. And if you actually calculate how many atoms are there of these different elements, it leads to an estimate of about almost 2 to 4 times the sun's level of metals. So that is truly remarkable, because 6 billion years ago, this galaxy had formed 2 to 4 times the amount of metals that the sun has formed. So how on earth can that be possible? And so the European Southern Observatory, which runs those very large telescope where we got this data, they got really excited about this and they made a press release and so on. But since in the last few years, we found many more such objects. For some strange reason, these objects that have less gas, they seem to be, a large number of them seem to be really rich in metal. What does this have to do with galaxies? I'll come to that in a minute, but here is that same plot I showed you before. Metals amount of metals, 0 is solar level. This is a log scale, so minus 1 means 1/10th of the sun's level, and 1/100th of the sun's level, and so on. And this is look back time. So those lines are what those models are predicting, and the blue points are what these strong, really strong absorption lines were showing. And they found earlier, as I mentioned before, that we don't reach anywhere near the sun's level. But when you look at the weaker lines, you in fact see that they're far more metal rich on average. And they might be expanding, they might be evolving, they might have come up to the sun's level much more rapid. So something is weird about these objects and these objects. It's almost like they're two separate kinds of galaxy populations. How much time do I have? So this might explain, at least in part, this missing metals problem. If we have enough of these guys, then maybe there is no missing metals problem, because the metals, remember, that were expected to be there according to the models, they are not maybe in these objects, but they might be in this other class of objects. So we are expanding our surveys of these objects and actually also trying to obtain more of these red points up here to actually really bring down these big error bars here. But each point here contains about 30 points, contains about 20. So that would be very interesting if these gas poor systems somehow had more star formation and more elements, formed more metals, and the gas rich systems somehow did not form enough stars and are still mostly pristine without much metals. Okay, any questions so far?
Formation rate of when the galaxy coalesced out of the matter. So you got different starting times.
Yes, that is absolutely right. But, you know, we can, that's why
and sizes make different rates.
Sorry?
Larger galaxies may process faster.
That too, and I'm going to come to that. Because see, right now we don't have any clue how big those galaxies are.
Yeah.
All we know is how much gas there. Because we haven't seen them. So, that's exactly the kind of thing that we would like to understand. How big are those things that are producing these dips in spectrum? What kind of galaxies? Is it a spiral galaxy? Is it an elliptical galaxy? How vigorously is it forming stars? How bright are those galaxies? How big and all? So that's why the other thing we are trying to do is trying to image those galaxies. So really deep images of the quasar. We have no idea where the galaxy is. This is really the frustrating part of it. We know it exists because it casts a little absorption dip in the spectrum. But it could be right in front of the quasar, right? Which makes it really... Usually, you know, the quasar is really bright, and this little faint galaxy on the line of sight, it's far less bright than the quasar. So the quasar just overwhelms the light from the galaxy. The other problem is oftentimes the angular separation between the quasar and the galaxy can be very tiny. So you know, most resolutions, the two images just blur into each other. You can't resolve. So one way to overcome that, we're trying a variety of different approaches, including the Hubble telescope, which has much sharper resolution. But one way to do that from the ground is to use adaptive optics. Here I have a card here. That might a little bit. But adaptive optics is basically, probably most of you have heard of this, it's a technique to obtain really high resolution imaging. Right? Originally a military Star Wars technology that was declassified and then has been used autonomous. Most of the world's big telescopes now have adaptive optics. And I think even some of the amateur telescopes are coming equipped with adaptive optics. You have that, is that right? Okay, yeah. So it's amazing that it's becoming available on our scales.
Money. They cost too much.
Money. Lots of it. That's good. But, you know, certainly there's no point building a huge telescope if you don't have adaptive optics. Because as you know, very rapidly seeing in the Earth's atmosphere becomes a limiting factor. That's why telescopes like Gemini and Keck and VLT and so on, they all have these adaptive optics, which incidentally are just now becoming finally robust. It's not easy to use these things. But finally becoming a... So what it's shown here is a is an image taken with adaptive optics camera called Hokupa, which is Hawaiian word for fixed, unmovable stuff. And why does it have that funny name? This was taken on Gemini telescope, Gemini North, with that adaptive optics camera. So the left picture here, that is the original image of the star. Right? And this down here is the surface plot of the intensity. So it's, but when you turn on the adaptive optics, light just gets sucked into the core of the image. And you get a really sharp core. And compare this to that with the system on. Works. Yeah, you can see this is Neptune without adaptive optics and stuff. Becomes that very sharp looking. So the idea here is basically have a tiny little deformable mirror. So the shape can actually change. It's very small. It's like a tertiary mirror. But its backside, on its backside, you have little piezoelectric actuators. Apply some voltages to them and they move back. That changes the shape of that little plastic mirror. And plastic in the sense of the material, but deformable mirror. And when that happens, that changes the light path. As a result, you can cancel out whatever bad things the atmosphere did to the wavefront. So this is done, this is checked by a computer in real time, several times a second, and then figure out what corrections. So the computer figures out how badly distorted your light. Then it figures out how can I adjust my mirrors so that the image becomes flatter. Okay? And it keeps doing this in real, almost in real time, and out comes this much sharper looking. So adaptive optics has been used mainly in galactic for things within the Milky Way, for studying circumstellar material or planets and things like that. We said, why not use this technique for things really far out and try to detect these absorption line galaxies that are so close to the quasar but are normally just blurred with them. It's almost like having a planet in front of a star. The planet is so faint compared to the star. And it's hard to separate it unless you have really. So that idea actually worked out pretty well. Originally with Gemini and last few years with Keck, we've been using the adaptive optics systems there. And in particular, what is shown here is this laser guide star AO, adaptive optics. What they do here is they shoot out a laser beam, a very powerful laser beam. And that goes and hits a certain sodium layer in the Earth's atmosphere. And then the sodium starts producing a virtual star, an artificial star, because of fluorescence. And then it's as though you have an artificial star in a certain part of the sky. And if you point your adaptive optics camera at that artificial star and keep that star in sharp focus, then any area surrounding that will remain sharp in focus. So you can actually obtain really high resolution images with this kind of technique. And what we have got recently is 0.08 arcseconds, full width. This is in the infrared. In optical, we still don't have we are still nowhere near doing this. There are some systems that may become available on, but in infrared, we can reach really good. In fact, this happens to be higher than even what Hubble can do from space. And the reason for that is because Hubble is a 2.3 meter telescope and Keck is a 10 meter diameter. So fraction limit is much sharper. So what do we see at such? Imagine we can actually separate out the galaxy from the quasar. All right. So on the left hand side here, the original image. This is a quasar, that is the galaxy. You can very faint galaxy, can you even see it? This separation, quasar to galaxy, is 1.2 arcseconds. Right? From any other instrument that we had access to before, we could never resolve the galaxy from the quasar. And the scale here is 0.01 arcseconds per pixel. We never have any hope of separating the galaxy from the quasar, but because of the adaptive optics, our resolution is 0.08 arcseconds. So we can actually, there's many pixels between the galaxy and the quasar. Now, if I subtract the quasar out, because I'm not really interested in the quasar, I'm interested in this fuzzy galaxy. Now, why am I interested in it? Because it shows very strong absorption lines.
How far away is this?
This is at redshift 0.7, so 6 billion light years. 6.3 or something. So I don't really care about the quasar, but I want to understand what kind of galaxy this is, which is producing this very, very metal-rich object that I showed you earlier. Remember that spectrum I showed you? This is the same object that has maybe 4 times the sun's level of metals. Something is weird about this object, and I want to understand what is weird about it. So move the quasar's light as best as I can, and stretch the contrast enormously, and then finally, then I get this. So this stuff here is actually not real. It's the leftover residue after doing the PSF subtraction, as subtracting of the what's called a point spread function, of the removing the instrumental effects of the telescope. Even the world's best telescope is going to leave, it's not going to give you a pinpoint of light because of diffraction. So you have to remove, you have to account for that. And after we take out our quasar light, you know, this stuff is basically lack of the absolute. So don't believe anything here. But this is the galaxy. And it's much better. And if I smooth it, you know, this is in a sense almost too much resolution. So if I smooth it, I can increase my signal to noise ratio. And when I do that and make a contour plot, I can see that it's basically, it's not a spiral, it's not a nice disk. It's something like an elliptical or a bulge. It's got a big bulge. This gap. So at least in, so you know, bulge to total ratio, the light, the ratio of the light from the bulge to the total light is about 40%. This is a, almost an elliptical galaxy, which produces this. So this seems to suggest that, and we have images of more objects from various other instruments as well. It seems to suggest that perhaps the difference between these metal-rich and metal-poor objects is that the metal-rich but gas-poor objects, those evolve faster. And elliptical galaxies are known to do that. They evolve much more rapidly than spirals do. That's why ellipticals don't have much gas left. They're purely almost stars. Because all the gas was consumed or lost back into space. Whereas spirals took their sweet time in forming stars. So they still have a lot of gas and a lot of beautiful nebulae for us to look at, but ellipticals. So maybe what we are detecting here is the absorption signatures of ellipticals versus spirals. And if that's the case, this would be, we might have detected the earlier, you know, the young stages of ellipticals versus spirals without actually having a clue what those galaxies are. About that, but in the interest of time, I'll say something about dust. I spent some time in the beginning talking about why dust is so great, why we should observe, so on. So what do we know about dust in the distant galaxies? Actually very, very little. The observations of the distant supernovae that people use to claim that the universe is accelerating, right? Those observations like that, they have to correct for effects of dust. Because if dust is there, as you all probably heard about Hubble and how the original value of Hubble's constant was wrong, because of lack of correction for dust and things like that. Dust can have profound effects because it can completely fool you. Something is much. So despite the importance of understanding whether dust in the faraway galaxies is like the dust in the Milky Way, very little is known about dust in the distant galaxies. And the reason that matters is if dust was very different in the early universe than it is today, then the way we correct our observations, correct for dust, that is going to be different. And then a given galaxy could be at a completely different distance. And then your whole Hubble scale is wrong. He claims that it is wrong, but I'm just giving you an example of how that can lead to serious problems in how fast the universe is expanding. So because we know very little about the nature of dust in the distant universe, people normally just assume that dust is like that in the Milky Way or like that in the Magellanic Clouds, the LMC or the SMC. But we don't really know that it is like in the Milky Way or like in the Magellanic Clouds, because those are just some of the nearest galaxies. So what we've been doing in recent years with the Spitzer Space Telescope, which is the infrared one of the big NASA great observatories, but it's in Israel, that we're trying to detect signatures of dust in faraway galaxies. Right? In particular, we are focusing on the silicate cores. If you remember the cartoon of interstellar grains have core made of graphites and silicates. So the silicate may be like a bunch of silicon, oxygen, magnesium, iron atoms, molecule made up of those. And then on the outer side is the lighter stuff, like silicates in the core, those are, they actually contain mass of the interstellar dust grains. But previously, nobody had actually tried to look for these silicates in faraway galaxies. So with the Spitzer infrared spectrograph, we actually have the wavelength coverage. This is mid-infrared now. So wavelengths, that feature, there's a feature of silicate, an absorption line of silicate, absorption band rather, of silicates that is near 10 micrometers. So way past even near infrared, the mid-infrared. And because our galaxies are redshifted, you know, I'm looking at high redshift objects, that means it's redshifted to maybe 20 micrometers or 30 micrometers. So you really cannot do this from the ground. But Spitzer could do it because it had the detectors that are sensitive to infrared. And what did we find? We made the first detection of these silicate molecules in one of these gas-rich objects. In fact, from Hubble, it was known that perhaps you might have heard of the bump in the UV that is present in the curve, not in... but that is this very strong bump that is seen even in this very distant galaxy. And that's believed to arise from carbonaceous dust. So that's why we picked this object. And we know that it's got a lot of gas. It's clearly called a damped Lamanoff absorber. And indeed, when we looked at this object with infrared telescope, with the Spitzer infrared telescope, we found a absorption signature because of silicate at the right kind of position, at the right position, 10 micrometers approximately. In fact, this is, you know, it may seem like a weak feature. This is, you know, this is the continuum level, and about 90% of the continuum. So it's not a very profound, very, very deep, subtle and broad feature, but we have enough signal to noise to actually detect it at more than, we're doing this with many other objects now. So to conclude, what can we learn about the ISM in the distant universe? We can learn a lot, both about the gas as well as the dust. We can learn about the metals in those, in the gas. I did not get a chance to talk about molecules in these distant galaxies, but even molecules have been detected. Things like water have been detected at redshifts of 0.7. 7 billion years ago. So you can, because of those absorption lines, you can actually get a great deal of information about the interstellar and faraway galaxies. And our studies indicate that perhaps through these gas pore systems that are very rich, and the gas-rich metals pore, we might have found the progenitors of ellipticals and spiral galaxies. And that would be very interesting. Enlarging our samples to see that gas-rich metal poor DLAs, they became the spirals, and the gas-poor metal-rich objects, they became. So things like this, studies like this that combine spectroscopy and imaging, they can offer a direct look at the ISM in very objects, you know, going back more than 10 billion years. That will be very important for constraining our models of how galaxies evolve, how interstellar material evolves. So I will stop there, but if you have further questions, I'll be more than happy. Yeah. I'll try my best to answer. Yeah.
The reference to gas-rich metal core, the galaxy is spiral, right?
Yes, it is.
It's metal-rich.
Exactly.
I'm confused.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Okay, what I'm saying is it still has a lot of gas left. Right? So If you compare the spirals versus ellipticals became rich in metals a long time before spirals did. So if you look at, don't think in terms of quasars, if you just look at galaxies for the sake of galaxies and get determine abundant metallicities of different galaxies, ellipticals became metal rich far before spirals did. So far before our Milky Way reached its present value, ellipticals would have done that a while ago. So that's what this kind of difference.
So there can be metal in spirals too, it just takes longer in a spiral.
It takes longer, exactly. Yeah. So our Milky Way has still got lots of gas left over, and it can still keep forming metals over many more billion years.
You mentioned something about less star formation earlier in the presentation.
Yes.
Can you extrapolate on that a little bit?
Okay. Right, so the way they got this plot is by actually measuring the, you know, the brightnesses of these the galaxies in the UV. And then calibration between how bright a galaxy is in the UV and how much, at what rate stars are formed. Because the UV light, you know, the UV light comes from the hot massive stars, like O stars, which live for very short amounts of time. It gives you, observing hot stars, UV light, that gives you the instantaneous rate of star formation. Right. So you can get a star formation out of UV images. Yeah. So that's what they did here. And they figured out, and then, you know, within a given redshift bin, they added all the galaxies whose redshift is, and what is the total rate of star formation within a volume, 1 megaparsec, 1 megaparsec, 1 megaparsec. Like, that's what is plotted here. And what found was that today, this suggests that today's star rate of star formation is about, you know, less than what it was. So even in the Milky Way, stars are forming today, but the rate at which Milky Way is forming stars is of the order of one solar mass per year. But if you go back in time, your galaxy is forming stars at 20 solar masses per year. Barely even 100 or 200.
And why was it faster in history and slower now?
Okay, that is, apparently there was this golden epoch in the history of galaxies where there was a lot of, I mean, this incidentally also coincides with other things, like when the quasars, you know, were really active. So quasars, you probably know, there are a lot less quasars now than there were earlier, and there are a lot fewer quasars at very high redshifts as well. So apparently at this particular epoch, galaxies were merging more actively. There had a lot of black holes getting fueled in the center because of mergers, and you had a lot of quasars around. And that was all tied to also a lot of star formation, because mergers also give rise to star formation. You've seen the image of the antenna galaxy. Right? So the region in which they collide, there's a lot of young star clusters, for example. So, there was, for whatever reason, this is not completely understood, but for whatever reason, galaxies were simply at their best.
Spread out, and they're not colliding as much.
No, there were, yes, I mean, they were more spread out, that's true. They're more spread out now.
Now.
Yeah.
Once a nebula arises, there's really no material left.
Exactly. The other problem is...
No, but, so what is your question?
No, I was just saying...
Depends on how you define a galaxy being formed. Yeah,
another galaxy is evolving a bigger galaxy. I know that.
Yeah. We see that. It's also driven by mergers.
Is it possible somehow?
Talking about today.
Yeah.
Well, again, you know,
locally,
I mean, things that merge.
I know.
In this sense, a new galaxy is
formed.
We don't know if a primordial black cloud that is collapsing for the very first time.
Very, very minuscule point.
Absolutely.
So the sample rate is very...
Yeah, there are not too many of these objects around.
And where are you picking? You got a fairly large variability of what you could be going through or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So one other thing I'm trying to do that I didn't mention is we have some cases where the quasar is gravitationally lensed to multiple quasars. So instead of one single quasar, you have a galaxy in the front and it's lensing that quasar, you may get four quasar images. Mm-hmm. So then you get four cyclones all through that middle galaxy. So we are doing observations of some of those objects to see how things compare within different parts of the galaxy. Also, another technique that I also did not mention that we are using at a large telescope is called integral field spectroscopy, where at every pixel, instead of getting just an image, you get a spectrum at every pixel. Yeah? If you do that, then you separate out the light of the quasar completely, and you can go as close as you want to, because if you look at only certain spectral lines, the quasar is at a different redshift, and the galaxy is at a different redshift. So quasars... Quasar doesn't have the emission lines that the galaxy has. Okay. So the wavelengths where the galaxy can be very bright, quasar may be totally dim. The galaxy will then stand out next to the very dim quasar. So that is possible also. And through that, we can actually get a three-dimensional map of the things within. It's kind of like doing tomography. Because spectrum through at every pixel. In that as well. But you know, all of these techniques are relatively new. And as you correctly said, we have our sight lines are pretty unique. So our samples are limited by that. However, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey in Apache Point, which was done at the Apache Point Observatory in New Mexico with a 2.5-meter telescope, that has observed over 2,000 quasars. And we have now much bigger samples of quasars to pick our sight lines from. Many of them are much fainter than whether still we don't care about how faint they are. But as long as we can get a spectrum of the bigger the sample. Yeah.
Across the
world, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you team up?
Well, we usually meet in meetings. Some of these people are my students, so they're here. If you know of any students who would be interested, please let them. We're always looking for good students. So some of these authors are my graduate students, and but the other people, some of them are, you know, my past collaborators at various institutions. The other ones are new people that I meet and interested in the same kind of topics. Good question. All the data that I showed you was pretty much data we got ourselves. We had to put in proposals and rule about how they grade these things. But luckily, most of the other data, like the, you know, these 100,000 quasars, 200,000 quasars in the Sloan, that's all sitting in the archives. It's public. Two archival studies as well, using. Because oftentimes the reason they got the data is completely different. They may be interested in the quasars. Archival research is another great thing.
Yes.
I'm sorry I went over.
Oh, no.
It was good.
We always are glad to see somebody.
Science, yeah.
But, you know, if I just show spectra, then people get confused.
Thank you so much. All right. Before we break for refreshments, does anybody have show and tell?
We got a couple pictures we wanted to show, like that break when it got clear.
Let me hook my laptop back up real quick.
42, the one in the thing, was one of them, but we got a few more.
Well, while you're doing that, I can do a quick one. All right, go ahead. I've observed trying to put stuff together when it's very cold and you can't wear gloves because you can't feel the nuts and bolts. And I was in the auto store working on looking for something to keep my hands clean, and I came across these super tacky. Gloves. They've got a nice rubber on them and cloth line, and you can put on and take it off better than you can bare finger. So I'm hoping they will offer a little bit of sub-zero temperature for taking stuff on and off.
Right,
six bucks.
Like all those zones?
Yeah. They were super tack gloves in the mechanic section. And they've been used. I just looked right. They will,
you can wash them.
Yeah.
This was another one we got Sunday night. We wanted to do some globular work, and we were debating on using the 14 or the 110 refractor, and I talked him into using the smaller telescope, and that's why the glob.